Welcome to The Partial Historians.
We explore all the details of ancient Rome.
Everything from the political scandals, the love affairs, the battles waged, and when citizens turn against each other. I'm Dr. Rad.
And I'm Dr. G. We consider Rome as the Romans saw it, by reading different authors from the ancient past and comparing their stories.
Join us as we trace the journey of Rome from the founding of the city. To a brand new episode of The Partial Historians. I am one of your hosts, Dr. Rad.
And I am one of your other hosts, Dr. G. Welcome to the show.
That sounds like there are more to come.
Can you imagine if we expanded our repertoire and brought other people in as hosts? I don't know if the vibe would be the same.
No, I don't think our listeners could handle it. We're already too talkative.
Too fabulous.
Exactly, yes. So, Dr. G, I'm so glad to see you because it's been too long since we talked about the history of Rome from the founding of the city. Why, it feels like more than 24 hours.
I can't get enough, to be honest. And
I know.
I'm excited to dive in because on the back of where we just wrapped up, which was 431 BCE, and I'm still getting over Vettius Messius being such an incredible dude.
And then disappearing without a trace.
Suspicious.
I know. I mean, I think we all know what happened to him, but still.
Did it involve stabbing? Maybe.
You don't get to throw a name as fabulous as that out there, Livy, and then not tell me what happened to this man.
Look, Livy is letting you down right now. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, Dionysius has disappeared, so, you know, glass, houses, stones. Let's just
I might not have any sources, but boy, do I have names.
That's right. Now, Dr. G, let's do a quick recap. So we've given a bit of a hint there about what happened last episode, but where were we up to in the narrative of Rome's history last time we spoke?
Look, as far as I can remember, it was a pretty exciting year full of ups and downs, military prowess by the Romans, everybody heading out down south for a bit of a battle at Mount Argidus, and just mayhem, generally speaking. I believe there was a dictator. Could be wrong about that.
There definitely was a dictator.
I had lots of like little supplementary sources hinting at various things that happened in this year because it was Tibertus as dictator, and he was quite an incredible figure, and he's made it into the history books, partly on the back of a story that we're not sure can be fully ascribed to him. It might be apocryphal, that involves the killing of his own son for disobeying orders on the battlefield.
Yeah, Postumius Tibertus showed his stuff on the battlefield against the Aquians and the Volscians to great acclaim, and then, bit sour for us, not for the Romans, killed his own son. Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah. If so, tragic, but also a huge demonstration of Roman virtus, placing the state before anything else.
Exactly. So basically we left Rome on a bit of a military high, I suppose you could say, last episode.
Yeah, they're excited.
Yeah, exactly. Which means it's the perfect time to transition into another year. So I think we're heading into 430 BC. Dr. G, so it's 430 BCE. Tell me, who's in charge?
It's a good question. I literally have the names of the consuls and the names of the censors, and that is almost all I have in terms of source material.
I kind of figured, yeah. I kind of figured, and that's why I thought I'd let you tell me who the magistrates were.
That's very kind of you. So, as you know, Dionysus Halicarnassus is sadly missing in action. He's becoming more and more fragmentary and will soon be completely gone. The Fasti Capitolini is also missing for these years, so we're relying on some Fasti records that are kind of like a little bit of a backup system. This means I'm left with source material like Diodor Siculus, a little reference from Cicero, and a bit of Festus, which has never really been translated into English, so I had to do a bit of a dodge on the Latin.
Latin? Oh no!
I know, I used to be all right at Latin. Now it's just a little bit tricky, but you know, I gave it a whirl. So our consuls for this year, Lucius, in brackets, or Gaius, Papirius, son of nobody, grandson of nobody, Crassus, consul for the second time apparently, also consul in 436 BCE.
Yeah, I remember his name, Papirius, I remember that
name. Papirius Crassus. And he is joined by Lucius, or Gaius, Julius Vulpiscus, Iulus, also a patrician, and was previously military tribune with consular power in 438, for people following the career, like a red-hot razor, and was also most famously master of the horse in the previous year to Tibertus himself. So this guy has been elevated from being the master of the horse to the consulship. Fancy Nancy.
Nice, nice. Now, I believe you mentioned we have some censors as well.
We do. And, I mean, things are going to get a bit weird with the censors, I think, as I'm sure you're about to tell me. But we have Lucius Papirius, who sounds like he must be related to Lucius Papirius, the consul. And I was like, I don't think this is the same person. But I also can't be sure. Rome.
I'm not going to say anything yet.
Rome and their names. We've got two Lucius Papirii. What could be going on? And we also have Publius Penarius as the co-censor. So the job of the censor is count everything up, basically check how the population is going, look at the distribution of the wealth and so forth. So I guess we'll see what happens.
We will. I mean, the censorship has been in for some controversy in this past decade, so it's interesting that we have censors named again. Now, look, I'm not going to lie. Livy does not have a huge amount of detail for this year either.
Yes, I'm not alone.
I'm going to say, I think this episode might be a low point for Livy as well, and you'll see why later on. Not as it is not interesting, but just as in terms of the depth of the information provided. But we'll get to that in
dear
a second.
Dear.
So of course, here we are in 430 BCE, and what are the tribunes of the plebs pushing for but military tribunes with consular power? I think you can already know how that wound up, given that you've given me the magistrates as consuls.
Yeah, so they wanted this year to be filled with military tribunes with consular power. Is that the idea?
Yeah, they wanted military tribunes with consular power, but didn't get there. It seems to be the way, to be honest. They seem to lose more often than they win in this battle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the previous year, as we mentioned, we had some conflict with the Aquians and the Volscians mentioned, and the Romans did pretty well in that scenario. In this year, the Aquians, erstwhile enemies of Rome, sent envoys to the Roman Senate requesting a treaty.
Ooh.
The Senate come back to the Aquians and say, you know what, why don't you just flat out surrender and say that we're awesome and we're the man and nobody can beat Rome?
Fascinating. Okay, so that's not really a treaty. That's just they're asking, Rome is like, rather than a treaty, how about you completely submit to us?
I think that the Romans are doing what I try and do, which is you ask for something that's more than you want. And then you work your way down.
I see. A great negotiating strategy from the victor of the battle.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, it ends up happening that the Aquians secure an 8-year truce with Rome.
Okay, very specific. We'll see how that goes.
I know, it is very specific, isn't it? 8 years. Like, why not just an even 10, guys? Yeah. Just an X.
I mean, they use base 10. That's odd. Okay.
Yeah, anyway. The Volscians, of course, were also defeated in this recent military combat that was going on. But internally, they're now facing division. And to be honest, I love this because we often find that we end up talking about like what's happening in Rome after something big has happened. So it's kind of nice to get a sneak peek into what apparently is happening for the Volscians. So there are those who want to secure peace with Rome and those who want to, I think, pursue more war. So they're kind of arguing amongst themselves, which means Rome is in a very peaceful state right now. There's not a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. Well, if the Volscii aren't organized, and they're probably still mourning the loss of Messius as well, I dare say. They're kind of like, if we can breed them like that, maybe we can take the whole place and make it our own.
Who knows? So the Romans turn to what they normally do in peaceful times, which is needless bureaucracy.
I see. The censorship, I sense, is coming.
Yes, this is where it is coming in. So Livy mentions that there was a new law introduced regarding the valuation of fines, which was very popular with the people. Now, what had actually happened was that the tribunes of the plebs were actually putting this law together and they knew it would go down well with the people. Unfortunately, one of them got a little bit too chatty. Loose lips sink ships, Dr. G. And so the consuls end up putting forward the law before the tribunes and they get the credit.
Oh, no. Okay, so the tribunes come up with a great law only to have it stolen out from underneath them by the consuls. Fascinating.
Yes. Yeah. Now, of course, I had no idea what they were talking about in terms of what this actually involved.
I've got a little bit of detail on this, I think.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say, this is where I think Cicero comes in.
Yeah. Yeah, so Cicero sort of jumps in to breach the gap, as it were, of all of our other source material. And, you know, he's spooling on about a whole bunch of things like Cicero does, but he's honing in on this moment of the censorship, and he gets the names right, generally speaking. And he talks about this transfer of the imposition of fines. So, and it's something to do with lightening the fine load for people and figuring out how to measure that so that they can distribute the fines appropriately, but also lower their sort of consequence and effect. It seems like fines are getting out of control and nobody's very happy about it. And their choice seems to be to shift a number of cattle out of private ownership and into public ownership. Now, these are two details, and I do not know how they're related. How does shifting some cows from private to public ownership actually alleviate the situation with fines? And I think this is related to how they measure wealth. So how they count up somebody's assets for the censorship test. If the cows are owned by the people, the public, as it were, rather than by a certain person individually, then that cattle doesn't count to your asset marker. So you're looking after some cows, but you don't technically own the cows.
Interesting. Yeah, well, when I was sort of doing a bit of digging into this, the previous law that was replaced by this law was apparently a law called the Lex Aeternia Tarpeia, which was introduced in 454 BCE, so not that long ago. And it apparently had set up the conversion rate for fines. So one ox was the equivalent of 10 sheep, was the equivalent of 100 pounds of bronze, or 100 asses. Oh, yeah. Give me that boudet. Yeah. Apparently, we're not entirely sure what is happening with this new law, but we think that the conversion rate is what has been made more favorable, and probably because there might have been people who wish to pay in money rather than in things like cattle, I guess. And so it kind of might have ended the optional payment. This is just a theory. This isn't set in stone. It might have ended the optional payment, and it might mean that all fines had to be paid in money from this point onwards.
Ah, this might tie in, I'm not sure necessarily how, but Festus does suggest in a passage 220 from the Lindsay edition, if anybody's keen for that, that it was about estimating cattle based on the hundreds within the herd.
Right.
And then sheep were estimated based on the tens in the herd. So yep. they came up with a new counting method that allowed them to count less, essentially.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. That might be the conversion rate kind of thing. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-mm.
All right. Well, clearly something is going on. It's getting mathematical. I don't care for it. Shall we move on to 429 BCE? Because that is all I have.
You want to end this year on the high note of bovine counting, and we'll leave it at that.
I think I'd like to. I'd like to leave the cows behind. Let's move on.
Or ooh, as the case may be. All right, well, that wraps up what a year to be in Rome.
Okay, 429 BC, tell me, what you got, Dr. G?
Well, no surprise, Dionysius of Halicarnassus is missing.
I had a hunch. I've learned from history.
I think I have even less source material for 429 than I did for 430, which is kind of abysmal, because all I've got is the consul names.
Mm-hmm.
And a little snippet from Diodorus Siculus, who, as we know, tries his best, but is often a little bit confused. So, I mean, I'll take you through it. We have, as our consuls, apparently Hostus Lucretius Tricipitinus.
Oh, I hate that name. Yeah.
Tricipitinus.
Yeah.
And Lucius Sergius Verdinus. And he's consul for the second time, previously consul in 437, and also previously, and a little bit more recently, military tribune with consular power in 433. And they're the only magistrates I've got names for this year.
I don't have any other magistrates either, so strap yourself in. This is what Livy tells me happened in 429. Nothing. Nothing happened.
Yeah, what now?
Yeah, no, Livy. not as in he's missing like Dionysius, as in he actually is there and he just says, look, nothing happened. So let's just move straight on to 428.
Oh, incredible stuff. Livy, I mean, he loves to talk. I can't believe he found nothing on this time period at all. Well, that means my source becomes very handy. Diodorus Siculus, you're back in the mix, buddy. So the thing with Diodorus Siculus, and it's been going on for a while in his narrative, is that there is about a 10-year discrepancy or more between the things he tells us and when they happened and how they might line up with when the Romans say that they happened in Rome. So the analysts may be a little bit out in their count. Diodorus might be a little bit out in his count. But the thing that he's giving us that the Romans aren't giving us yet is he's lining things up according to the Athenian dating system, the eponymous Archon in Athens. And generally speaking, historians feel pretty confident about those dates. So it's a bit problematic for all of the Roman writers like Livy to be like, it's 429, when Diodorus is like, it's 422.
Well, that's helpful.
We've got some missing years. Somewhere in there, something has happened. But the thing that redeems the Roman analysts and where Diodorus then immediately lets himself down is he gets everybody's names slightly wrong. So
it doesn't bode well.
No, it's not great. I feel like he's probably maybe okay on numbers, but he's not great on his source material. So there's a lot going on. He says the consuls for this year are Opiter Lucretius. Opita being a name that we've never heard of as a praenomen, so
no.
Nice try, but probably wrong. And then Lucius Sergius Fidenates, which is very close.
Yeah.
Very close. He's just gotten the last one a little bit smushed up.
Yeah, but I'm not giving him a cigar.
Yeah, but maybe you overheard it at a dinner party, you know? I feel like that's the Diodorus Siculus way, where it's like somebody's saying the names to him and he's writing them down. He looks at his notes later and he's like, what did I even put there? And he just tries to guess for the manuscript.
Yeah, look, I agree. Certainly there have been modern academics that have suggested that actually if we probably should shift events around a little bit, and that there probably was stuff happening in this year, but just in the version of Livy that we have, the way that Livy chose to record things, it seems like a very dull year indeed.
Nothing to report, eh, Livy? Well, well, well.
So I think we're going to go for a record. That means we're on to 428 BCE.
Oh, we are speeding through things.
I know. Oh. People will think we've had a stroke.
Dear listeners, calm yourselves. It's a whole new year again.
Now, this is a bit of a confusing year as far as magistrates are concerned.
This is very confusing.
Yeah.
And we've got some, there's a whole bunch of potential issues here. So, for instance, one of the things that I was holding on to for a long time, and I think I flagged in many episodes prior to now, is that Dionysius of Halicarnassus kicks back in about 428. But I think I was mistaken about that.
Oh.
Having read what is there in the source material in preparation for this episode, I was like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like 428 to me at all. So some minor revisions might have to take place.
That's all right. As long as we know that we're going to briefly catch a glimpse of him again one day, that's all we need to know right now.
He shall return, not in his full glory, but he'll be back, okay, limping across the finish line in his fragments. So we have two sets of consuls in this year, as far as I'm aware. Which means we have to divide them up between the consul ordinarii, the ones who name the year, and the consul suffecti, the ones who sort of fill in the back catalogue. But I also have, and this is where Broughton, bless his soul, is always so helpful, also notes that there is a special commission this year.
Yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of people involved in the special commission. So we've got plenty of names, even if we're not really quite sure what is going on.
I think I can help you with that. Livy actually does provide you with some detail this year. So why don't you tell me who the magistrates are, and then I'll try and fill in the blanks.
All right. This sounds good to me. It's a deal. So our first consul is Aulus Cornelius Cossus.
Not the most handsome man in the world.
You may remember him, dear listeners, for being awesome.
Yes.
In 437, where you may have first encountered him, he was merely a military tribune. But this year, he's actually a consul.
Nice.
So, you know, I mean, I don't know what he's been doing for the last 10 years, but I'm going to assume he's even more handsome than before.
Absolutely. Handsome men don't need to work hard for political office.
I wouldn't assume so, especially when women have the vote. Oh, wait. And then we also have Titus Quintius Poenus Cincinnatus, another quite familiar name at this point.
It is.
This is his second bite at the consular cherry, previously consul in 431, and also most likely one of the sons of the very famous Cincinnatus.
I was going to say, he's not the Cincinnatus.
No. Poenus Cincinnatus is one of the sons of the very famous twice dictator Cincinnatus, for those tuning in from Cincinnati, and possibly also the younger brother of Lucius Quintius Cincinnatus,
right?
Who has exactly the same name as the great man himself. So very confusing. So those two are consuls. Then apparently we have another two sets of consuls, and that would involve Lucius Quintius Cincinnatus,
right,
the brother.
Yep. Just to make things even more confusing. Yep.
two Cincinnatuses consul in the same year.
Does that make them a Cincinnati?
I think it does. I think we've reached the Cincinnati moment. It's finally happened. And also Aulus Sempronius Atratinus.
We've heard that name before.
I mean, it sounds vaguely familiar to me, but I haven't written any notes on that, so have not done my due diligence with that guy.
No, I don't think it's necessarily the same person, but I do remember that name of Atratinus. And of course, Sempronius, I mean, the Sempronii are going to pop up again and again.
They are going to have a long legacy as a patrician family.
Yeah.
So that's our two pairs of consuls. Then we head into our special commission, and I'm excited to learn about what this special commission might be all about. But it involves at least three people. Lucius Sergius Fidenus, who cropped up in the previous year as consul. So Quintus Servilius Priscus Fidenus. So two Fideni in there.
Yeah.
And Mamercus Aemilius Mamercinus, who we also have previously seen, was a military tribune with consular power in 438, and also seems to have been appointed to investigate the participation of the Fidenates in the raids led by Bay.
Yeah, so this is what I'm going to fill in a little bit for you, so let's get to it. Okay, so we've got our consuls of Cossus, who, as you mentioned, was our ridiculously good-looking tribune who managed to defeat an Etruscan king on the battlefield, had the whole spolia opima thing going on for him, which nobody but Romulus had managed to do. So what a consul. And then we also have Titus Quintius Ponus Cincinnatus, as you said. Now, what starts to happen under their consulship is that the people of Vei start to make moves on Roman territory. A common tale. We have talked about the fact that this time period, as much as it seems to be filled with these awesome Hollywood blockbuster epic battles, really seems to be this constant niggling of Rome and its neighbors, and they're constantly trying to get each other's territory and steal each other's stuff. I mean, honestly, it feels a bit like kindergarten sometimes, Dr. G. Now, it was also rumored, as you just mentioned, that some of the young men from Fidene were in on these raids, okay, and were taking part. Lest we forget, the Romans aren't feeling really great about Fidene right now. Do you want to remind us why?
There seems to be a bit of a problem. So in the history of Fidene, it starts out as a Roman colony. That seems to be its how it comes into being. So the Romans always consider it theirs. And it's actually a really strategic anchor point to the slight north of Rome, because it sits on the same side of the Tiber as Rome. And this means that they've got a sort of like a defense in the north that allows them to sort of feel more at ease about where their enemies might be coming at them from. Problem for Rome is that the Fidene populace decides that they're not having anything to do with Rome anymore, and they decide to throw in their lot with the Etruscans, which makes a lot of sense. The Etruscans are really quite close. They are a much more numerous people. And if you were looking at a side-by-side comparison of who you should ally with in this time period, you've got Rome, a single city, a little outpost run by a bunch of gangsters, versus the Etruscans, who have centuries of history in the region and a full 12-member kingship going on. There is a lot of power and a lot of history there. They're well embedded in their power structures. So it makes sense that a reasonable offer might have been made to Fidene, and they fluttered their eyelashes at Vey and said, "Why, yes, of course, we'd love to join you." And Vey and the Etruscans now have a strategic position to filter into Rome from a side that they're not usually able to approach the city from.
Strategically important, absolutely. So obviously, bit of taste in the Romans' mouth. They're not going to tolerate these rumors that are going on. They're like, look, it's one thing for Vey. Like, we expect it from Vey. But Fidene, after everything we've just been through, I do not think so. So, as you mentioned, a special commission is set up. I feel like we need to have some, some crime music. And so we've got Lucius Sergius, Quintus Servilius, and Mamercus Aemilius, according to Livy, who are put in charge of looking into these rumours. And some men could not account for their whereabouts at the time in question. So I'm definitely feeling the Law and Order vibes right now.
You don't have an alibi? Why, no, sir. I was sleeping in the field.
Yep, they were away from Fidenae, but where were they? Who could vouch for their whereabouts? Nobody, that's who. So they are banished to Ostia.
I mean, that's pretty disappointing that they couldn't even get a friend to lie for them.
It would seem to be pretty easy back in this day and age. I mean, it's not like they're battling, you know, CCTV and mobile phone cell towers pinging all around. Nonetheless, the goats were quiet that day and nobody could say where they were. They're banished to Ostia, and I guess Rome is also starting to think about, what can we do with this whole Fidenae situation? Because clearly they're still not really on board with this whole idea of being allied with the most awesome city-state in all of Italy. Not that it's known as Italy right now, but hey. So they decide they're going to send more settlers and establish, well, not establish a colony, but reinforce the colony at Fidenae. And so they take land from the property of people who had died, and they give it to the new colonists. So they're sort of trying to, you know, set them up.
Okay. Oh, so they shift some things around, and like,
yeah,
it's an off-world opportunity.
Some creative accounting.
It's going to be very exciting for you. Here, take this stuff.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that might be said for this year is this is the year that Cossus holds the consulship. So. For some scholars, and it would make sense to go down this path, this is actually the year where the king of Vei, Lars Tolumnius, is met in battle and is slain directly by Cossus.
Okay, see, I have that a little bit later in some of the stuff I've written. So definitely the fact that he's consulship now is,
this is one of the candidates. This is going to crop up again in a couple of years.
Exactly, yeah. And of course, we've also got Mamercus Aemilius, who, also has those connotations. So yes, this is one of the candidates, but I definitely, with my Livy narrative, because you know Livy is my man, I'm going to plump for a bit later on. But anyway, so we've got our colonists set up at Fidenae. And then, of course, it's been far too peaceful and Disney-like for too long, Dr. G. A drought hits. A really, really bad drought.
I see. Okay. I think these things might crop up in a slightly different year for me. So we'll see. I'll keep going.
Okay.
I'm interested.
So Livy tells me that it's not just the fact that it's not raining very much, which is part of the problem, but also what he calls perennial streams do not have enough water. So I think that probably means that obviously where people would normally locate their water, which, you know, they don't usually have any problems from the sources that they're drawing from the ground, they are also drying up.
So creeks and small rivers are also dry.
Yes,
this is bad time.
Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, when we don't have enough water, what happens? People start to die. So basically, the cattle are the first to die. So they start dying and you find them sort of strewn all around these dried up water sources where they would normally go to get a drink. And they're also starting to die from mange, which is still a disease that can afflict various animals these days. But basically, it's some sort of skin condition, which is caused by these parasitic microscopic mites. And what ends up happening is when you've got all this drought, people are suffering, cattle are suffering, cattle are dying, cattle are disease. Sure enough, a disease spreads from the cattle to the Roman people. So at first, you start to see people who are living in more rural areas and slaves starting to die, but then also it spreads into the city. And it's obviously, again, I mean, I feel like only yesterday we were talking about a bad sickness in Rome, but it seems like once again, the Romans are really suffering badly.
Yeah, I think we would have to assume that if we're in a situation of this kind of drought, we're looking at years of consequence, not just a single year.
Like, yes.
In order to be in a situation where usual water sources are actually dry. This is an ongoing drought that's been happening for some time and is now getting quite severe.
Absolutely. Now, the people, because they are suffering so badly, they start getting desperate. Mm. And what Livy terms foreign superstitions become very popular. And other people in Rome are starting to take advantage of the situation, presumably to make money like cash, I would presume, but presumably to earn some sort of financial gain or to win influence with people. So some people are pretending to be seers. So sort of taking advantage of that superstitious state, desperate state that people are in. And they start talking the Roman people into adopting new types of beliefs and weird ways of sacrificing. And it's happening in their homes. The leading citizens start to notice that it's spreading everywhere and that there are just like strange sacrifices happening all over the city, because the people just, they can't help but think that they've done something to upset the gods, and that the only way that they're going to make it right is if they figure out, you know, what's the right offering? What's the right sacrifice? How can I possibly, you know, restore the balance between our people and the gods? So it seems to be getting out of hand. I'm going to unpack what this all means in a second. Eventually, the aediles are put in charge of ensuring that everyone returns to normal, and I'm using my flesh rabbits, religious practices, and that they return to only worshipping Roman gods in a Roman way, god damn it.
I see. I mean, it makes a lot of sense that things like this would happen. And it is also quite interesting that the Roman response to this is not that sort of expansive, inclusive sort of approach that we see much later in Rome, where they really do just sort of absorb and embrace and adapt different modes of worship into their own way of doing things. This seems to be like a distinct moment of crisis in terms of like ritual practice brought about by environmental crisis.
Yes, absolutely. And I think we can sympathize with that these days, even though it might not necessarily be an environmental crisis, although it might be. We see people in tough times these days. Often that's the moment that they find some sort of faith because, you know, when push comes to shove and you're desperate, you might look for answers in places you haven't considered before. Now, that's not to say that the Romans haven't considered being religious before, but they just might be looking in, you know, into new gods. Now,
yeah, well, certainly if the rituals that they've been performing haven't done the trick and this drought is getting worse, then it would be a reasonable thing to assume that maybe there's something wrong with the ritual practice.
Yes, so looking at how academics have interpreted what Livy is saying here, because he doesn't give me any specifics about exactly what kind of practices and that sort of thing, it seems to be assumed that he's referring to the cult of Apollo. So you might have forgotten, but in 431, they dedicated a temple to Apollo when the people were suffering from that really terrible plague. It had actually been vowed in 433, but it wasn't until 431 that the temple was, you know, up and running. And so it might be something to do with that.
Somebody built it wrong. You gotta take that down.
Well, it might just be that that was like, you know, the new cult on the block. Apollo. Yeah. So it might be that there is something like that going on. It's possible that's what they're referring to. And it won't be the last time that we see this kind of outbreak of extreme, well, what the Romans saw as like more extreme or superstitious practices, like people getting, you know, a bit caught up in things. We're going to see this again when we get to the years of like the Second Punic War and that sort of thing.
Mm,
yeah. Now, the weird thing,
fascinating.
Yeah, the final weird thing I'm going to note is that we, of course, have the seemingly plebeian aediles. Now, it's not explicit that this is who they are, but possibly it's the plebeian aediles who have been put in charge with restoring everything to rights, which might not seem to add up at first if we think about the kinds of functions that the aediles serve later on in Rome's history, where they're more concerned with, I suppose, more prosaic matters of life rather than religious beliefs. But for this earlier period, it does seem that there is potentially a connection for them where there is that sort of religious aspect, obviously. I mean, all magistrates, obviously, it's not like in the modern day where you have a real separation between politics and religion. Obviously, all magistrates are going to be involved in religious practices somehow, whether it's the rites they have to carry out or whatever. But we've seen also that it seems like the Aedhals were the ones put in charge of the publishing of the 12 Tables. They also possibly were overseeing senatorial records and making sure that they were kept at this point in time. And they therefore might have been seen as valid people to be overseeing how people are observing their religion, I suppose. And that, yeah, they have this sort of religious aspect to their role.
Interesting. Very interesting. So we have this mention of Aedhals. We don't know. We don't have any names.
We do not. We do not. And as I say, this is all speculation. We don't really know what's going on here. We don't have enough detail. And it's not that they're trying to wipe out the cult of Apollo. They're just trying to make sure that it doesn't get excessive. And that there is a balance between what and who the Romans are worshipping.
And there's also the broader question of, like, what's going on with, like, the demarcation of responsibility here. So we have had previous years before now where we've known who the Pontifex Maximus is.
Yes.
And it doesn't happen very often in this early period, but they have been mentioned. And we also get this sense, particularly from very early on, definitely pre-Republic, that there are a whole bunch of really quite significant priesthoods that are already in existence, such as the Fedeales, such as a whole bunch of sort of priests to Jupiter, priests to Mars, the Pontifices as a college, augurs. And so the idea that it is in this moment that the responsibility is delegated to the Aediles to try and sort out this issue does raise some questions.
It does. And as I say, it's just a theory, but I think it does sort of highlight that we honestly can't say a lot for certain about a lot of people's positions at this point in time. It's not that they're not obviously a priesthood, as you're saying. They're not a priesthood. As you say, it's more that something's been delegated to them and that they might have been seen as the kind of people that were able to oversee something like this.
Yeah, the idea that this could fall within their remit somehow.
Potentially. But again, like, I think it just sort of, even if this is just a theory, it's just once again a reminder that we really know so little about exactly what being a consul in this period, you know, involved.
Well, yes. And yeah. I mean, it's worth noting that often this has been simplified as well. Like, when we talk about consuls in this period, we're not even sure that they're called consuls.
Exactly.
Yet.
That's what I mean. There's so many question marks. And this just sort of highlights that if you look up what an Aedile does, this would probably not be something that I think they were normally associated with when you get later in Rome's history.
Yeah. And we're in this period where nothing is solid.
Exactly.
Uncertainty is high.
Yes.
Well, I think, unless you have other details, this might be the place to wrap up this episode.
That is all I have. But I will say that some of the details that I've just given you are going to come back in the most major way. You have no idea. Or maybe you do. I don't know if Dionysius has kicked back in or not, but the next episode, some of these little seeds that I've planted, they are going to flower into something horrible.
Oh, I can't wait to find out. Yeah. Well, if you share your story with me, I'll let you know what I discovered.
All right, Dr. G, that means it is once again time for the partial pick. All right, Dr. G. So this is the point where we sum up, well, normally the year that was, but in this case, it's the 3 years that were. And we rate Rome out of 5 different categories. And in each of those categories, they have the potential to score 10 golden eagles. Something tells me it's going to be rough today.
Yeah, look, in a year where nothing happened. Well, all right, so let's see how they do. The first category is military clout.
Nope, they're too sick, really.
I couldn't fight. I had the mange.
Yep, so that's a zero. So what's our next category?
Diplomacy.
Okay, well, there is a little bit of that going on here. We've got the truce with the Aquians.
That's true, and they did negotiate some people out of Fidenae. Get you to Ostia, and we'll bring in a pack of Romans to replace you. I mean, it could be seen as diplomatic.
For the Romans, I think that is diplomatic. They didn't just outright kill them.
Not yet.
So what, like a 4 or 5? I mean, it's not that impressive.
Well, I feel like, yeah, the diplomacy with Fidenae doesn't count for much, I don't think. No. That's maybe a 1. But actually coming to an 8-year truce with the Aquians and the Volscii, that actually does sound pretty
just
substantial.
Just the Aquians. Don't you dare throw the Volscians
Okay. Don't throw the Volscians under the bus like that. I retract. The Aquian Treaty. Truce, I should say. It's not a treaty, a truce for 8 years.
Yeah,
look, I'm going to give them about a 5.
Okay, so we'll give them a 5. All right, so we've got 5. What's our next category?
Expansion.
No. Been a while, I feel.
It's hard to expand under these conditions. They're being pressed from all sides.
They are, and internally.
Mm.
The cows. They eat the sick. Yeah.
Sorry, I was like being pressed internally. I went somewhere else. Virtus.
Can't say that I do.
Not a lot of Virtus going on. No specific examples come to mind. They're just they're doing Roman things, but and citizen score.
Look, for the first 2 years that we talked about, the fact that there's a lot of peace, that nothing is happening.
There's fines being alleviated. I mean, it all sounds pretty good, really.
That's pretty good. It's just, unfortunately, we've bundled it together with this hideous drought, which makes everyone really suffer and makes them ill.
Yeah.
So it's going to be balanced out. I think maybe like a 4.
Points for reduced fines. Taking away points for the mange.
Well, given that we're not really entirely sure exactly what that whole fine business involved, it's all very speculative.
I'm assuming it benefits the rich more than it benefits the plebeians, but I could be wrong about that. We have very few details.
Well, they say it was popular with the people, so I'm presuming it was actually to their benefit. And don't forget.
Look, the people have been into things that haven't been good for them before.
This is true, but the fact that Livy says the tribunes of the plebs were the ones that are originally coming up with it and then the consul stole their idea, I don't know, maybe.
Well, maybe a 4 then, as you say.
Okay, well, that actually, you know what, it's better than I thought, although not great when you consider it's 3 years rolled into one. Come up with a total of 9 golden eagles, Dr. G.
Wow, Rome, you've really excelled.
yeah, they definitely have. Hey, you know what, though? It's definitely better than some of the other years we've dealt with in the 430s. I thought that the Decemvirate was a bad period, but actually the 430s have been rough.
They have. I mean, between like the absence of source material and just like hit after hit to the Roman psyche, it's been a tough time.
Well, Dr. G, there's no one I would rather talk about nothing with.
I'm going to take that as a compliment.
Absolutely. Join us next time for the podcast about nothing.
Oh, the history of Rome from the foundation to nothing.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Partial Historians. You can find our sources, sound credits, and an automated transcript in our show notes. You too can support our show and help us to produce more intriguing content about the ancient world by becoming a Patreon. In return, you receive exclusive early access to our special episodes. Today, we'd like to give a special shout out to some of our newest Patreons, Daniel, Nicole, Vincent, and Michael. There are other ways that you can support our show. We have merchandise, a collaboration with Bridget Clark on Gumroad, and we now also have a book. And you can find all the details of that on the Highlands Press website, as well as our website if you'd like to purchase a copy of Rex, The Seven Kings of Rome, a popular history. However, if you were a trifle short of denarii, we would massively appreciate it if you told someone about the show.
That kind of recommendation is worth its weight in gold. Until next time, we are yours in ancient Rome.
Hey, Dr. G, would you know what to do if a phallus started flirting in the fire before you?
Probably not.
Well, then have I got the book for you. Did you know that we wrote a book?
What? We wrote a book? No way.
I think we wrote a book. Yeah, absolutely. We wrote a book and it's called Rex, the Seven Kings of Rome.
Oh, that's right. The details are starting to come back to me now. Yes, yes. The regal period. What a time for the Romans to be alive. And also what a time for historians to revisit and to consider the source material.
Absolutely. So if you're interested in picking up a copy of our popular history of the Roman monarchy, please head over to the Highlands Press website.
That's highlands-press.com.
It'd be a great way to show your support of the show and to get a great read.